So I'm here with Matt today, and we're going to talk about information security, cyber warfare, cyber conflict, that sort of thing. So let me start off with, you know, give us a basic sort of evolution of cyber conflict and cyber warfare, because I think sort of, you know, in our discussions, we talk about conflict and cyber warfare, but there's also this, you know, element of terrorism, of crime, information warfare. So, you know, give us a basic history and evolution if you can.
Yeah, sure. It, you know, unfortunately, we haven't come that far over the past 20 years, and there's still people that'll argue about some of the definitional aspects of what is information warfare, what is cyber conflict. So it becomes a little confusing, but in most instances, people try and map it to what we understand in the real world. So information warfare back 20 years ago was seen as something that was kind of completely within the cyber domain and was warfare that could be conducted. And now people see it as something that is more closely aligned with traditional aspects of warfare in that people are dying. Either military service individuals are dying or civilians are dying as a result of a cyber attack. And what that does is kind of opens up the landscape for discussions of kind of other sub-tiers, information operations, things that take place that are kind of non-warfare, but that involve using cyber tactics, techniques, and procedures. Cyber conflict, you know, which are conflicts that occur in cyberspace that manifest themselves without impacting public safety. And then you have cyber terrorism, which is the utilization of cyber attack by terrorist entities in order to, you know, achieve a political objective or attract attention to a group or cause. There's some debate, you know, going back over, I guess, like 18 years now, over just what is cyber terrorism. Do we have to align it with the information warfare and say people have to die as a result of the cyber attack, or would an attack on an economic system or a transportation system that doesn't result in the loss of life be considered cyber terrorism? And I think that'll boil down primarily to what is the intent of the attacker and kind of what is the actual outcome of the attack. And then we have the criminal activity, which has been around for many, many years and continues to increase in sophistication, whereas they even start adopting some of the tactics of the state actors, adding more confusion to the realm if you're on the defense side to try and understand exactly who is attacking you. And then we have this aspect of kind of other activities migrating into cyberspace. So espionage and issues of stealing secrets or engaging in kind of clandestine operations online. So you have a real huge blend kind of across the spectrum of different cyber-related activity.
Interesting. So where do we put sort of black hats and white hats? Because it seems like, you know, I think from what I've seen sort of through interacting with this community, it seems like the cyber, you know, people who do conflict, warfare, whatever, it seems like there's a lot more variation in roles. That as a white hat, you work for Microsoft one day and then you work for the government. As a black hat, you do research and you sell exploits, you do, you know, you hack for profit. So I'm curious, you know, where do we put this, you know, black hats and white hats? I mean, is that delineation even sort of fair to describe the roles?
It's tough because, you know, as with everything, there are kind of different shades, right? So it's kind of a gray hat in between. And it's the same argument that we've been having over the term hackers, right? When the term hacker first came out over 30 years ago, it was meant to imply it was somebody that had a keen interest in technology and how it worked and wanted to tinker with technology and figure out, you know, how do I make this thing break? How do I get it to do things that it's not intended to do? How do I get access to pieces of it where it's trying to restrict me from getting access to those components of it? And then in the, you know, late 80s with, you know, some of the Operation Sun Devil and the rounding up of kind of these low-level criminal hackers or teenagers that were engaged in what I would call kind of the cyber equivalent of smashing mailboxes in the real world, you know, going through a phase in their life where they were hacking into systems with kind of non-malicious intent, but what was still illegal activity, the term hacker kind of morphed to represent the criminal side of the space. And that was unfortunate because it stayed that way for quite some time. If you go and look at the stories, you know, about hackers, it's all about the criminals. It's not about the people that wanted to make the technology better or wanted to find the weaknesses and in finding the weaknesses, make the technology stronger. Now, you know, we've kind of had the reemergence thanks to promotion at, you know, places like Facebook. You know, if you walk the halls of the Facebook campus, you'll see posters about hacking and engaging in hacking attacks internally or having a hacker mindset and how they approach technology and to break things and make them better and use them in unanticipated ways, then you have this kind of more positive connotation of the term hacker. Kind of the same in the white and kind of black hat realm. I mean, originally black hats were viewed as the malicious or criminally aligned attackers. But today we have a conference like the Black Hat Security Conference that's been around for over 15 years that brings together a lot of the researchers that are using those kind of hacking techniques, you know, breaking things that aren't supposed to be broken or probing things in ways they're not supposed to be probed, with the sole intent of making those technologies better and raising awareness as to kind of the security vulnerabilities. So, you know, the white hat hacker, black hat hacker distinction, I think, is also kind of grayed the same way that we have the, you know, the distinction between hacker and what is a hacker. So I prefer to refer to, you know, what you would traditionally call the black hat kind of criminals just as criminals. It's cyber crime. They are cyber criminals. They are out there engaging in attacks for malicious purposes or primarily for financial gain. And then you have a white hat, black hat community, you know, focused on defending networks. And the white hat community may be more focused on defending networks using defensive technologies, and the black hat community more focused on how to defend networks using offensive technologies, so breaking them to make them more secure. And that's kind of the distinction that I use today, is let's call the criminals criminals, and let's try and save the, you know, the other connotations for legitimate players within the security space.
That makes sense. So I'm going to switch gears a little, because I think this is sort of, my next question is sort of something that I've been having a difficult time sort of reconciling or sort of thinking about. But, you know, in the practical world, in practice, you know, how do we define cyber conflict? And I mean, do we sort of layer it on to, you know, interstate conflict sort of between U.S. and China? You know, do we, you know, is it a component we add to our understanding of terrorism and insurgency? I mean, where do we, you know, in practice and sort of looking at it and studying it, I mean, how do we think about this?
Yeah, I think we, you know, want to focus conflict on kind of a contested domain type of approach, right? Just it's happening in cyberspace. So that contested domain might be amongst nation states, you know, trying to hack into each other. And engaging in attacks. It might be a manifestation of something like Stuxnet, right? Yeah. Stuxnet is basically a non-proliferation tactical approach applied in cyberspace, right? It's with the intent to disrupt a country's ability to build, you know, a nuclear capability or what could later lead to the development of nuclear weapons technology. So non-proliferation, but a kind of contested domain utilizing cyber attacks that were somewhat destructive, right? They caused the equipment to operate in ways that it shouldn't have operated. So I would put that into the kind of cyber conflict domain as well. And then the rest of the stuff, you know, I really think we have the appropriate context in looking at it from a crime perspective, right? We view terrorism for the most part as criminal activity. And with the cyber crimes, the same type of thing. There is a criminal element that is engaged in attacks with criminal intent. So, you know, diving back into kind of the cyber conflict space a little bit deeper, what other forms of cyber conflict might we have? Well, you might argue that some of this kind of traditional espionage kind of falls under a conflict type category, depending on the types of attacks that are taking place. Does the espionage get included in there? I don't think so. I think we keep a separate category for intellectual property theft and things that occur from a theft perspective, getting access to secrets or getting access to intellectual property. I think we keep that in the espionage category. But what happens if a attacker breaks into a power plant and disrupts the operation of the power plant? That I would put, you know, if it's done without the intent or doesn't result in the loss of human life, put that in the conflict domain as well. So I think we'll develop maybe more granular categories as we start to have more and more experience with these different classes of attacks, right? The espionage aspect of cyberspace, even though it's been around for 20 years, is something we've really just started to refine over the past 3 to 4 years with the disclosure of the Aurora attacks on Google and all of the discussion regarding advanced persistent threat and kind of espionage activity originating out of China and Russia and other locations. I think we'll see that same type of, you know, granularity develop around cyber conflict and maybe the splitting out of some of the categories over time as we experience those types of attacks.
So I'm curious then, you know, for interstate exchanges. So, you know, between the United States and China in terms of stealing intellectual property and between the United States and Iran, I mean, how do you do sort of mediation and sort of negotiation? Because, I mean, it seems like, you know, with the Talin manual that we're trying to approach a sort of legal, you know, try to engage in a legal approach and a treaty approach to sort of mediation and conflict resolution. I mean, do you think that this is sort of an approach that works? And B, you know, in practice, would it work? Because I mean, sort of the environment you've described is that it's like a combination of espionage, criminal activity, and then conflict, but yet it's all, you know, the delineating categories and delineating sort of acts is
different. Yeah. Yeah. And I think for that reason, it's going to be tough to come up with, you know, real strong legal frameworks, at least right now, you know, until we apply kind of more granularity to it. Again, you know, the legal framework might work for, you know, should other nation states be hacking into the, you know, control systems for major infrastructure, even if it's from a purely planning perspective. You know, they don't have any intent currently to utilize that capability, but might have the intent to utilize it, you know, for in future conflict, either conventional or in cyberspace. How do you categorize that in a, you know, kind of a legal approach, right? Becomes very difficult. Does the legal framework exist solely on the consequences or the actual launching of the attack, or does it deal with the kind of the preemptive measures to put a potential attack in place? The example I like to use is, you know, if you're prior to World War II and you're president of the United States of America and somebody comes and briefs you and says, hey, you know, we think that there's going to be a high probability of conflict with Germany. And we have an ability right now to put explosives in ball bearing plants, and we can do it completely clandestinely. They will never discover it. And if we don't engage in conflict with them, we don't ever have to push the button. But if we do engage in conflict with them, it would be strategically advantageous to have this capability to take the ball bearing plants out. So if you're president of the United States, what do you do at that point in time? Well, we're facing that same type of dilemma in cyberspace right now. Our adversaries are as well. You know, from the Chinese perspective, if they look at things from the perspective of, well, we could have continued prosperity or we could have conflict. We could have cyber conflict. We could have kind of regional security issues that arise in conflict or confrontation from a military perspective. And if we see a potential future for conflict, would we be remiss to not plan for the cyber elements of that conflict or things that might act as either deterrents to military operations or as, you know, give us a strategic advantage in the event that conflict breaks out? So refining that type of activity in any sort of legal framework is going to be very difficult. From an espionage perspective, becomes a little clearer, right? It can just be don't engage in intellectual property theft. But there, I think you also have this issue of dealing with a different perspective from a culture standpoint. For example, you know, we believe very strongly in intellectual property protections and having legal frameworks around that. And trade and commerce globally. And if you look at it from a Chinese perspective, they might say, well, we invented many things as a society over thousands of years, you know, gunpowder and printing press and things of that sort. And those existed in a time frame when intellectual property protections were not in place. Yet the rest of the world greatly benefited from the creation of those technologies and used them basically license-free, right, from an intellectual property perspective. So why now, over the past 50 years, when you've had a period of innovation, should we be applying more stringent intellectual property controls than what were applied to our contributions to society over the past thousands of years? Right, so if you look at it from that perspective, it puts it in kind of a different kind of legal framework, right? So now we'll have to reinforce our beliefs, you know, our views on how intellectual property should be protected with trade agreements and tariffs and things of those sorts that start to have real teeth with the Chinese economy. I don't think that we'll convince them to stop engaging in this activity just from the perspective of, well, hey, this is kind of legally wrong and that there's global consensus that this is legally wrong. I think they have a different perspective on what is right and wrong and what should be protected and what shouldn't be protected.
So, I mean, let me sort of ask the question this way. I mean, do you think do you ever think there would be a possibility of an arms control, a sort of arms control treaty or sort of arms control convention? Because it seems like, you know, if we sort of go along this path of international law, I mean, it seems like part of international law is arms control, you know, limiting, you know, the amount of, you know, nuclear weapons, you know, limiting the amount, the spread of small arms, et cetera. I mean, do you think that sort of approach can be applied to cyber conflict, or is that, you know, development cycles, you know, whatever, just won't allow it?
I think it becomes very difficult to do because of kind of the multi-use capabilities of these technologies and even determining what is an attack capability, right? With non-proliferation as it relates to conventional weapons, there are I&W matrices that we built, you know, over the past 50 years, components that could be bought, heuristics of sites where testing might be conducted, access to scientific knowledge and engineering resources, are all of these things that we watch for and try and disrupt, you know, from a non-proliferation standpoint, and that we can build, you know, some very clear distinctions that can be put into global treaties. You know, what a nuclear weapon is can be very clearly defined. How do you do that with a cyber attack capability? So if I have a zero-day exploit that can be applied against a large power company, I can use that to go in and steal their customer data. I can use it to go in and steal intellectual property, or I can use it to go in and disrupt the operation of the power grid. So defining things from a weapons versus outcome standpoint in cyberspace becomes very difficult because there's kind of a funnel. You know, if you look at from hacker all the way to nation state across the top, and the types of tools that they might use to achieve their objective kind of narrows down into an hourglass type shape and then expands back out based on the intent. So what we might have is looking at it from the perspective of, okay, who is the attacker and what is the intent of the attack tool being used? But developing any sort of early warning, you know, system or I&W matrices, you know, people have tried in the past for these types of attacks, becomes very difficult. I can go into Best Buy and buy a, you know, information terrorism toolkit, right, by buying a laptop and a network card. I can go on the internet and download tools. You know, that was a big issue I had back in 2000 when the director of the CIA said there were 100 nations developing information warfare capabilities. What does that mean if I'm trying to defend a network? Is that 100 nations that have invested millions of dollars in R&D in developing zero-day exploits and unique attack capabilities? Or is it 100 nations that have downloaded some hacker tools off the internet? So this is a problem that we've struggled with and will continue to struggle with. So I think the focus in this realm will be on, you know, where we can clearly define kind of the outcomes. Don't steal intellectual property. Don't disrupt the operation of infrastructure. Don't engage in attacks that have economic, you know, destabilizing effect or impact. Those are the things, you know, the outcomes of the attacks that we might be able to define, but as to defining what the weapons look like or restricting the weapons, it just becomes too difficult from my perspective.
Interesting. So, I mean, sort of, then you would argue that sort of the difference between sort of a Stuxnet and then a community version of Metasploit isn't really that they're both weapons, but rather that it's about outcomes. That it's, if somebody's using Metasploit to do a penetration test on, you know, their company's network versus taking it and stealing bank account information or getting access to a computer. That it's really about outcomes, not particularly the weapons.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's going to be the nature in which it is used, right? You might over time carve out, you know, if a weapon was or if a cyber weapon was designed with the sole intent of disrupting the physical operation of infrastructure, that might be something that you can carve out. And Stuxnet probably falls into that category, right? But I don't see where you would get, you know, I have a hard time seeing the global community agreeing on it. Including the United States, right? We want to reserve the right that we can utilize a capability like Stuxnet for what we viewed as kind of a just cause, non-proliferation type cause.
So let me, I asked Sam this question too, but in terms of creating these tools, so Stuxnet and Metasploit, how has sort of the open source and community versions of pen testing tools, how has it changed the environment? Or has it? Because I think in my conversation with Sam Lyles, he made this great point that, you know, from 1980 to now, like the relative amount of weapons designers and tool designers has stayed the same, but the amount of people using those tools has increased exponentially or a lot, whatever, you know, sort of the amount. But, you know, how has, does cyber weapon, cyber tool, you know, creation. I mean, how has that changed the environment? You know, the creation and the use.
Yeah, so it's in a couple of different ways, and I have a slide that I posted on my Twitter account a couple of months ago. People can look up that is stolen from a good friend of mine, Robert Garrig, who is Canadian military, and I worked with on a bunch of different vulnerability assessment teams back in the mid and late 90s. And it says, you know, it looks at things from a very interesting perspective. So if you go back 20 years, the technical sophistication of the attackers that were operating was fairly high because the technical sophistication of the tools was very low. You had tools that maybe would assist you in mapping out networks, maybe some rudimentary password cracking capabilities. But other than that, you were on your own from an attacker perspective. Then over time, what you had was an increasing technical sophistication of the tools, right? You have, automated frameworks being put in place. You have graphical user interfaces being developed. You have the kind of point and click hacking, right? So what that did is as the technical sophistication of the tools increased, it meant that the technical sophistication of the would-be attackers could decrease. So now you have more people that are able to engage in more consequential attacks because they have easy-to-use tools that are available to them. So that makes sense. The most sophisticated guys didn't go away. What you just did was added to that curve a whole bunch of people with less technical sophistication as the tools got more sophisticated and more user-friendly over time. So that's kind of one aspect to it. That also means now that if you have somebody that's developed an open source framework that is very capable, those folks with very established expertise can become more narrowly focused, right? They can apply that expertise in kind of very unique and distinct ways or kind of on the high end only of the spectrum because they're augmenting the capability of the tool. They're not building the entire framework from scratch. So these frameworks have been, you know, from a tool perspective, they've allowed, made the techniques much more accessible to a wider community, but then they've built an established framework for the really, you know, sophisticated attackers to build upon.
So then framework, I mean, who has the advantage then? Is it the state, the corporation, or the individual? I mean, it seems like, you know, as more and more tools become easier to use, relatively easier to use, and you would think that more and more individuals would be able to sort of launch sophisticated attacks against corporations and states. But so I'm sort of curious.
They are, yeah. So it becomes there's a bit of an arms race there, and that, yeah, if you don't maintain your security posture from a good hygiene from a defensive perspective, then, yeah, you're going to be susceptible to those people that can engage in the point and click attacks. But at the end of the day, the person that has the advantage are the folks with the best talent, right? A phrase from a slide I used to use back starting in 1996 that said, it's not the tools, it's the talent, right? You can give me whatever tools that you have, but it's the talent that can be applied to that. If you can apply if the nation states have the talent, then they're going to have the advantage. If you have corporations that are able to hire, you know, highly talented people that can look at their networks from an attacker perspective and develop protective measures, you know, they're going to have a slight advantage. If nothing else, then they're a harder target to attack than their competitors. So really, you know, the focus in this area, the tools does make the attacks much more accessible to folks, but their targets are limited to people with poor security postures. I think a good example of that, if you look at some of these operations that occur, I think there was, you know, Op Petrol or something that happened a week and a half to 2 weeks ago. And you go in and it's got a listing of sites. Here are all of the sites that were attacked as a result of Op Petrol, right? You don't see BP in the list, right? You don't see these major petroleum companies as targets because they've invested and have the talent to kind of protect their networks. What you see are completely unaffiliated sites that just happen to be put on the internet with a poor security configuration that were found by these attackers conducting, you know, the network sweeps on the internet, found the vulnerabilities, exploited it, and defaced the website in support of their operation. So, you know, the tools allowed for somebody to sweep and find 500 websites that were vulnerable. They just happened to be kind of inconsequential websites and unaffiliated with the actual target industry of the movement. So I think that gives you a good example of, yes, the automated tools contribute to the attackers, but only against folks that have a kind of less sophisticated security posture.
So then I'm sort of curious, where do we put botnets in all this? I mean, it seems like, do we define a botnet as a weapon, as a tool? I mean, because it seems like that we're also moving. I think somebody had posted on Twitter a comment that, you know, we're sort of moving into an industrial sort of type of hacking, meaning that you could do things on the scale of millions and billions and do it with precise efficiency. So you can use CarDerp or CarBurp or whatever the latest sort of botnet.
Yeah.
So, I mean, where do we put sort of botnets and sort of this movement towards, you know, industrializing sort of certain aspects of hacking?
I think botnets are just kind of a natural progression of the proliferation of internet connectivity, right? So people have made their ability to infect mass quantities of people much more efficient in their ability to derive data or utilize those compromised hosts. And again, it gets down to kind of the intent of the tool being used, right? So criminals will use botnets to do searches against the infected desktops for things like banking credentials and credit card numbers and things that they can use, PayPal accounts that they can monetarily exploit, right? They'll also use the capabilities of those botnets to engage in denial of service attacks, you know, where a, you know, maybe a regional peer competitor can, you know, hire a botnet and use the attack to take down, you know, another online gambling site so that people go and play poker on their site, right? Which is a kind of a common emergence of, you know, distributed denial of service attacks was against the online gambling community back in the early days. Or you might have a nation state that exploits the same exact botnet technology to steal secrets. Or you might have a nation state that purchases from the black market criminal botnet capabilities to engage in attacks that are kind of state-sponsored but with some deniability, which many would argue is kind of what happened with Russia and Estonia and some of the kind of conflict that occurred in cyberspace back several years ago. So again, it becomes very difficult to define kind of what role they play because they're utilized by just about every class of attacker out there today. What you won't have is a botnet for Stuxnet, right? You, for these tailored kind of surgical types of attacks, you're not going to see, you know, increased automation or kind of mass proliferation. But for the common criminal or things like distributed denial of service, you're certainly going to continue to see these botnets scale in size and scope and capability.
I mean, the difference between a Stuxnet and sort of a botnet, is it really, does it really boil down to sort of being able to code and being able to, you know, buy up every PhD, you know, computer science PhD, or is it a matter of sort of looking at exploits and looking at vulnerabilities, or is it sort of a combination of the two?
Yeah, it really, I mean, a Stuxnet type attack is a really kind of tactical, tailored, highly sophisticated type of attack, right? because you've got to go and find zero-day vulnerabilities in multiple platforms. You've got to come up with a way to kind of deliver that capability that kind of limits the scope, right? You don't want it to bleed out. And even with those controls, you know, did bleed out in a certain aspect. Whereas if you look at how a botnet is constructed, there might be some sophistication in that they have a drive-by zero-day vulnerability that impacts Internet Explorer browsers, right? So they can go and infect WTOP, which was one of the watering hole types of attacks we saw here in the DC area a couple of months ago. And anyone browsing to WTOP to check the weather, the traffic, or the news is getting infected, and the malware gets loaded on their system, and they become part of the botnet. That, you know, in some instances, there's that high level of sophistication to either get access to the zero day or develop the zero day. But with Stuxnet, you're building something that builds zero day upon zero day upon zero day upon a tailored delivery mechanism across, you know, in addition to across multiple platforms, including control systems. So the level of sophistication and kind of capability associated with each of those is hugely differential.
So let's sort of switch gears a bit. How do you do attribution in cyberspace? Because it seems like, you know, as a casual user, you know, I use Tor, or I'm aware of Tor. I'm aware of IPsec. I'm, you know, can do basic encryption, you know, TrueCrypt and, you know, programs like that. So I'm curious, you know, how do you attribute specific crimes and certain crimes to a specific actor? You know, how do you say this act was China, this act was Iran, this was anonymous, etc.? I mean, is it possible, or does it, you know, require a ton of energy to do so?
It requires quite a bit of energy to do it accurately for somebody who's willing to go through the measures to kind of protect themselves, right? Part of the issue, you know, when we talked about the China perspective on whether these types of attacks to engage in intellectual property theft are right or wrong. Well, if you don't have kind of any perception that they're really wrong and you're not, you know, ashamed of those attacks, you're going to take minimal effort to kind of cover your tracks, right? And also, you know, engaging in, you know, covering your tracks extensively decreases kind of the size and scale of the attacks you can conduct, right? Because as an individual, it becomes much easier to obscure, you know, or obfuscate my identity or who I really am or where I'm really connected from than it does if I've got 10,000 or 20,000 people. So there's kind of a scale issue, and then there's a, you know, how well does somebody want to protect themselves? So that, you know, for the sophisticated attacker that knows, you know, how to protect themselves, attribution becomes difficult. It becomes almost a human intelligence type issue where you have to be interacting with the attacker in some other capacity. You know, if they hacked into your bank and they took 100,000 credit card numbers, well, you might try and interact with the person online that is selling those 100,000 credit card numbers in some sort of Russian cybercrime forum, right? And gather information about who they are, you know, and attempt to buy them, engage in dialogue, and kind of track things down, right? Most of these attackers, you know, most every instance have some sort of social network presence, you know, social media presence. So you can engage in kind of what is kind of a human intensive or kind of underground operations intensive attribution operation against these kind of more sophisticated criminals. Now, if you have a nation state that's operating on kind of a smaller scale and is able to obfuscate themselves, I think it becomes much more difficult. I've worked on attacks where people said, you know, hey, this is China because it's a China sourced IP address and this is the activity that we're seeing. And then when we go in and actually do the analysis, it's not China. It's another entity. And they are routing themselves through China because, one, China has the largest install base of pirated Windows operating system in the world. So as a result, it means that they have the largest IP space of vulnerable systems existing out there. And B, because there's so much activity attributed to China, it's kind of easy to kind of hide in the noise. So there's a lot of misattribution that takes place as well, just based on people evaluating technical factors, saying, oh, I see that this IP address came from here. They're using this particular tool. Now, on a much more granular level, you know, in 2004, I wrote a book with Tom Parker called Cyber Adversary Characterization. There are things you can start to do from a evaluation of the code perspective. you can, you know, run some machine learning against the code that was used in the attack and see what is the technical sophistication. Are there habits, you know, kind of within the code or things that are done that are indicative of another piece of code that we've seen? Same with attack trees. You know, what a user does when they hop on a system tends to be unique. They tend to make the same mistakes or call the same commands or engage in kind of the same sequence of activities. So you can start to develop signatures and kind of databases, not only of the code that's being used, but also kind of the attacker habits. So as our ability to kind of incorporate more big data, get access to more malware, get access to more attack trees, we actually can start to develop kind of a more granular understanding of who these attackers are, at least where their roots are, you know, what type of code segments they're using, what type of methodology they're applying to the attack that help contribute to the kind of the great attribution picture. So if you had talked to me 15 years ago, I would have said attribution is one of the hardest things to do in cyberspace. But today, not as difficult because you have tools available to you from a defender and forensics perspective that allow you to apply, you know, some granularity with regards to the sophistication, the code in use, the habits of the attacker, as well as the ability to engage in these kind of underground operations slash, you know, human-based intelligence efforts.
So, I mean, so basically attribution is through sort of metadata then. I mean, you're not just looking at the code, but you're looking at sort of, you know, the data before the data. So
yeah, and looking at it. Yep.
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, yeah, looking at it in the context of kind of everything that takes place, right? You know, the metadata might give you some initial indicators, but it also might be intentionally misleading. So you can dig down and get greater granularity. Now, if it's a sophisticated nation state, and that's one thing I always like to say, if somebody attacks the transportation system and causes a plane to crash and 200 people die, and we trace it back to a source using technical measures, and the U.S. has said, you know, we reserve the right to respond, including conventional weapons, to any attack in cyberspace, well, what level of assurance are you going to want to have before you send that Tomahawk missile in to the location, right? So attribution from a kind of absolute perspective as it relates to retaliation or engaging in things that, you know, might involve the loss of human life, I think becomes a much higher bar. So while it's gotten easier to develop general classes of adversaries to trace back to criminals, I still think when you are, you know, involved in a state-on-state conflict or, you know, a non-state actor that engages in an attack that impacts public safety or causes a loss of human life, we're going to have a very high bar from an attribution perspective to justify any kind of kinetic retaliation. And that'll be primarily human, right? We're going to want to know that that person was on the keyboard at that point in time and engaged in that particular attack that resulted in those consequences.
So let me, this leads us to the last question then, you know, what is the appropriate response for being hacked? Because, I mean, you know, does a corporation look to the government to counter the threat, or is it really the corporation's responsibility to build up its defenses, you know? And, you know, more controversially, you know, is it, you know, should or can a corporation hack back? You know, this sort of term that they use.
Yeah. So there's a couple of questions in there, so we'll kind of take them in turn. So what should a corporation be doing? Yeah, they're absolutely responsible for maintaining an appropriate security level. And really it comes down to a risk management perspective. You know, what kind of threat attacks, you know, attackers are they facing? For the most part, over the past decade, they viewed it as primarily criminal, right? You know, if I'm a big bank, I needed to keep the criminals out and prevent the loss of my customer data or access to our networks that would result in financial fraud. Now, over the past few years, they've started to realize that in their risk management approach, they have to have some sort of, you know, threat protection from nation state potential activity that might involve large scale DDoS. It might involve theft of intellectual property. It might involve attacks that are designed to steal information around customers that can be used or exploited later for other means. But that doesn't mean that if I'm, you know, a local gas company, or if I'm a nuclear facility, that I have to be developing defenses against Stuxnet, right? So there's a certain level of sophistication, you know, that is only going to be prevented by the government. Not that the government would be securing that infrastructure, but would hopefully be kind of interdicting or developing the intelligence to kind of prevent the attack in the first place. So corporations have to have, you know, sound hygiene. They have to be implementing security programs. They have to be protecting against a certain level of threat. But there becomes a point in time when it's just not economically feasible because they're engaged in the act of commerce in trying to run a business and establish profits that they can protect against everything. So it really is a risk management perspective. What industry are you in? What is the impact of a potential attack? What does your technical architecture look like? What's the threat look like? What are the best practices in your sector? The problem, the reason why we have so many problems today with all these attacks is because a large number of corporations engage in very poor hygiene. You know, they don't have systems patched appropriately. They don't have the appropriate investment being made in information security. They're not subjecting themselves to red teaming and kind of independent assessment to see kind of what the attacker perspective on their network is. And then as a result, when even a moderately sophisticated attacker goes after them, or a B-team attacker, if you will, goes after them, they're compromised because they haven't engaged in what would be kind of considered diligent steps in maintaining their information security. So that's kind of the one piece. Yeah, there absolutely is a corporate responsibility for security, but there's also a government component of this where you can't expect that a, you know, resource-constrained company is going to protect against a nation-state attack that does not have any resource constraints. And where that line is, you know, has yet to be defined and may be defined in a court someday, you know, where a company gets attacked and the shareholders sue them and it's decided in court, you know, what is an appropriate level of diligence in cyberspace. Right now, you know, when I'm working with customers, we just try and get them to implement the kind of diligent to best practice, you know, engage in assessment, understand your vulnerabilities, make sure that you're engaging in, you know, great hygiene and have an appropriate security posture and you have an ability to engage in incident response and you've segmented out your critical data. There are lots of things that corporations can be doing. Go ahead.
No, I'm just curious. I mean, because it almost seems like there's not a lot of legal liabilities for companies, because it seems like, you know, even if the shareholders don't sue, it seems like as an individual, it's difficult to hold a corporation sort of accountable. In the sense, like, you know, I think about sort of, you know, what government agency as an individual can I go to hold sort of, let's say, a hotel accountable for being hacked and leaking out my credit card information? Yep. You know, because I think, I mean, let me ask the question then. Is there a legal component to this that we sort of haven't figured out yet?
There is, and I'm continually amazed that it hasn't manifested itself in any greater capacity. 13 years ago, I wrote an editorial back when there was the Mafia Boy distributed denial of service attacks against Yahoo and E-Trade and some of these most resilient internet companies that existed at the time. And I basically predicted that, hey, the real driver in information security is going to be legal liability. Because if I'm operating a company and I have a negligent security posture, say that I haven't implemented patches for over a year and there are vulnerabilities that exist, you know, that allow for an attacker to take over those systems, and the, you know, Mafia Boy attacker takes over that system and then uses it to engage in an attack that takes Yahoo offline or takes E-Trade offline, where there are real financial consequences of the attack, is there a liability? You know, can Yahoo and E-Trade now come and sue me because it was my resources that were used to take them offline? I was convinced 10 years ago that, or 13 years ago, that we were going to see the emergence of kind of that class of legal activity in cyberspace. I was also convinced that we would see kind of class action lawsuits as a result of information security negligence, right? So if I lose a very large customer database and that causes customer attrition, or I'm Sony and my customer account database gets hacked and now I have to buy privacy protection, you know, for all of my customers, and that costs money and decreases value to shareholders, I thought for sure we would see some legal lawsuits in that domain. They really haven't emerged yet. I mean, we had one case that occurred, you know, I think like 10 years ago, where the Department of Interior was ordered off the internet by a federal judge because of their inability to protect data surrounding Native American financial details. I think it was the Bureau of Indian Land Affairs or one of those related Department of Interior bureaucracies that had personally identifying information and financial details that they weren't protecting from the internet. The community sued them, and as a result, the federal judge said, hey, you know, you have to take yourself off the internet until you can demonstrate that you have an appropriate security posture. Why we haven't seen the manifestation of some of these lawsuits is kind of beyond me. And then the other aspect of this is that, you know, people will need to start rewarding from a consumer perspective those companies that provide appropriate security measures, right? So where you have choices in the market and maybe the choice to be more secure is, you know, a slight premium, or maybe there's no premium, but you choose that vendor because of the security posture, then that'll drive some of this activity as well. That'll drive the companies to spend more money on security because they'll actually be a market differentiator. Unfortunately, we haven't seen, you know, a huge market differentiator in consumer demand for security. Right? That's just been the reality. You don't choose to run a product over another product, or you don't choose to sign up for Facebook, you know, versus LinkedIn over security. Do you choose your bank based on how secure their posture is online? Do you choose your healthcare provider based on how well they protect your customer records? Right. So there are very few incentives from a corporate perspective, you know, aside from the impact of these highly consequential attacks, to invest in security if the consumers don't demand it.
So I'm sort of curious. I mean, the joke I like to make is, you know, Blizzard, the video game company, cares more about my security, my account security, than Bank of America. You know, and I think, I mean, does a lot of this have to do with sort of how a corporation conceptualizes its security, or is it really a market element that people have to sort of move away from that corporation based on, you know, that corporation not securing the information well enough? Because it seems like with Blizzard, you know, in the few instances they've been hacked, you know, accounts have been hacked or whatever, they quickly adapted. You know, they moved to, you know, two-step authentication, you know, constantly, you know, red teaming, but I don't really see that with Bank of America. And I think it's, to your point, I think it has to do with sort of the market dynamic then.
Yeah, I think you would see it a much greater extent in financial institutions. It's just not apparent to you. You know, for example, how many times has your Bank of America data been hacked as a result of a breach of their systems, right? Whereas on the Blizzard side, you know, your data was impacted as a result of poor security practices on their side initially, right? A lot of the financial institution attacks are not necessarily, and obviously there are exceptions to every rule, primarily in kind of credit card processing and things of those sorts, but are the result of the consumer being tricked into providing information that allows access to their credentials, vice somebody breaking in and getting access to your credentials and login information through the bank itself. So I think, you know, the banks would probably engage in more security activity. It's just kind of transparent. Now, the other aspect of that is, you know, it's reasonably difficult for a consumer to change their bank as a result of a breach, right? You've got to reconcile your accounts. You've got to close them. A lot of folks have credit cards associated with it. You have auto pay features where you're paying your telephone bill and your gas bill and your water bill associated with that. So it's a reasonably painful process to change your financial services provider as a result of a breach, you know, of data security. From a Blizzard gaming perspective, though, you know, what is the real cost to the consumer? It's access, you know, you lose access to their gaming environment, right? So I think they're much more concerned about customer attrition at that level, and therefore much more overt about their security measures and the steps that they're taking, because they want to build that customer confidence back up, because those customers, you know, those consumers of their technology can migrate to other platforms relatively pain-free, right? It is more of a choice. You've got less invested in the infrastructure, you know, unless you're a very hardcore gamer. So that might, you know, dictate kind of the difference in approach and the different perspectives there. The reality is, you know, on personal identifying information, we are seeing this movement towards, I think, you know, almost all of the states at this point have mandatory breach disclosure laws that say if customer data is stolen, that the company has to report that to the customers, right? So they can't sweep these things under the carpet. So they have to be much more overt. And we have the Securities and Exchange Commission recommending, but not regulating at this point, but, you know, recommending that if you have a breach of your, you know, security environment that has material impact, that you need to disclose that on your SEC filings if you're a publicly traded company. So there is a push towards more disclosure of these types of attacks. There's a push towards, you know, obviously with that, implementing tighter security postures as a result of, you know, some of this more lighter government regulation. Government's not saying you have to protect your consumers with this level of encryption and that the traffic has to go over SSL. They're saying if your customer data gets breached, you have to tell the customers, which means it's going to be in the press, which means customers might migrate elsewhere. So there's some kind of light regulatory pressure being applied, again, based on the consequences of the attack, vice the government recommending specific security measures.
So we're at the end of the interview, and I like to always give the guest the last word. So give us a sort of summary or encapsulation.
Yeah, so well, we didn't talk about hacking back, right? So that was kind of the third piece of that question that was kind of left unanswered. And here again is kind of a sticky area, so maybe we'll spend the last couple of minutes talking about that. This idea of active defense is not new. Again, it's been around for almost 15 years. You know, if you talk to Bob Gourley, he's got his email archive from back then. He and I were having conversations about active defense 15 years ago. I mentioned it in a public conference about 14 years ago in front of an audience with media in the room, et cetera. But what we've had is kind of this trying to develop a framework for what does active defense mean, and what are companies allowed to do. Right now, the current legal environment, if I'm a U.S. company, I can't hack back, right? I basically am breaking the law if I hack back, even if it's against a person who's hacking me as it stands right now. And, you know, the U.S. law enforcement community and Department of Justice has basically supported that that line in the sand, saying don't hack back. That doesn't mean, though, that we can't implement more kind of active defense measures at the ISP level. If they notice that there is a new botnet command and control IP that is stood up, and that there is data that is basically being siphoned out as a result of that botnet to this new command and control IP, there's no reason why they can't collaborate and black hole it, right? So that it doesn't get there. You've seen some of these initiatives with Microsoft and other folks where they go and take over criminal botnets from a command and control perspective and try and remediate the impact. So there is a role there that'll be played by corporations more on kind of the infrastructure level and kind of controlling access to networks and resources based on, you know, known kind of bad activity. But then there's a piece of this that I believe, you know, it should be much more proactive. And that kind of falls into a U.S. government perspective, in that I believe we should be hacking back, particularly against these botnet command and control or some of these more aggressive and overt mechanisms that are used in these attacks. There is no reason why, if that botnet command and control IP is known, and in looking at the traffic, you can easily discern that it's malicious activity, why we shouldn't have a strike team that goes in and basically neutralizes that that IP. The problem is that server could be located in a foreign country. It could be owned by a foreign company. It could be owned by a foreign government, which even further complicates it. But basically is a kind of a non-owned asset outside the United States. I still would make the argument, maybe right up until the, you know, owned by a government, in which case maybe we need some information sharing and some transparency where we provide the information to the government and the government takes action. But against some of these, you know, commercial IPs, I don't see a reason why we're not more proactive, where we don't have a strike team that can go in and say, okay, this server is obviously hacked. It's being used for command and control for this botnet. It is stealing secrets. It's issuing commands to engage in denial of service attacks. Let's go and take this server over and let's secure it and let's turn it over to its rightful owner. And oh, by the way, we're also going to gather the intelligence on all the systems that are reporting back into the botnet, and we'll share that intelligence back out to the impacted companies so that they can go and remediate the infections on their networks. Right? I have a hard time understanding why we're not more proactive as it relates to kind of those types of activities. again, you often get, you know, titles and authorities issues surrounding that. You get these issues of its privately owned server infrastructure. But I think we have some analogies for that already. Now, if it were a mailboxes, et cetera, that had a post office box that had been rented by Edward Snowden, I guarantee that we probably would go and gain access to that post office box and, you know, take the USB key out or the CD-ROM or whatever data residing. If there were a ship that were hijacked by terrorists that was approaching a U.S. port, even though that ship is flagged and owned by, you know, a private company internationally, I guarantee you that our special forces would board that ship and secure the safety of the vessel itself, as well as any crew associated with it. So I think we'll slowly start to see that type of thinking applied to the cyberspace domain, where we take a kind of more proactive active defense perspective. Again, like the legal liability, this is something that I've thought has been coming for the past, you know, the 13 to 15 years that hasn't fully manifested itself, but I'm still hopeful that we're going to see a more proactive security posture from an active defense perspective. I don't envision it ever being handed over to the private sector. I do think it'll remain kind of strictly a law enforcement and U.S. government type activity.
Interesting. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
No, my pleasure.
Thank you.